Over to Mr. Mathis.
Thank you. We've got two items on the agenda tonight, and I'm pleased to say the first is a neighborhood organization from North Central. Adam Saunders is going to lead off the group, but we'll hear from many folks. So,
all right. Welcome. Thank you. Thank you. Got a Prezi presentation here, so this I think it's ready to go, and we'll launch right in. Well, first of all, thank you all for having us out here tonight. We really appreciate the chance to talk with you all and share our vision. My name is Adam Saunders. I'm the Vice President of the North Central Columbia Neighborhood Association. We have five main points today. They're a result of a series of small group conversations that we've had among our board and our neighbors. They are to protect the tree canopy, de-emphasize cars while emphasizing walkability, maintain the scale, increase density while guarding against gentrification, and expanding mixed use through form-based code. And I'll come back to those again. North Central Columbia, a neighborhood with boundaries of Business Loop, Providence, Walnut, and College, is the most diverse mixed-use neighborhood in Columbia. And this is our greatest strength. We have, at last count, 774 units of affordable housing, a business corridor with a lumber yard, light welding, light industrial, four public schools, one college, two parks, several government buildings, several nonprofit health agencies, five churches, seven community gardens, and an urban farm. We're bounded by two main arterial roadways that were subject to the H3 design charrette, Providence and College. A few of our businesses are within the downtown CID. The North Village Art District manages the Arts Business Association. The Bike Boulevard crosses through the southern third along Ash Street. We overlap with three other neighborhood associations, CHA Downtown Residents Association, Douglas Park, and the Shoe Factory. So, needless to say, we have a very diverse stakeholders and very a lot of interest in our neighborhood, and it's very mixed use. Since its inception, the North Central Columbia Neighborhood Association has worked to promote and protect the benefits that are created by our proximate location to downtown. Now, we walk to school, to work, we ride our bikes, we shop locally. Many of those businesses are owned by our neighbors. We want to ensure that in the coming 10, 20, 50 years, that our current neighbors and our new neighbors can have the benefits that is unique to our neighborhood that we enjoy today. So we're sharing five main points today that are our vision for our neighborhood as it moves forward. One that protects our tree canopy, that emphasizes walkability and de-emphasizes car use, that maintains the scale of the neighborhood, increases density while guarding against gentrification, and expands mixed use through some form-based code. I'm going to turn it over to my neighbor, Dan, here.
Thank you. Dan Cullimore. I'm on the board for North Central. Our second point is that our vision emphasizes walkability and de-emphasizes cars. Did you have something to do?
I was going to talk about trees. I'm a forester. I like to talk about trees, and I totally jumped out when I was going to talk about trees.
Let the record show.
Let the record show. I like trees. And I miss my cue. So our first point is that our vision protects the tree canopy. We have many mature trees along the streets and between our homes and businesses. And this provides some critical green space and basically a forest canopy throughout their neighborhood. Many of these trees are over 80 years old, while many are considerably older. These trees provide a range of benefits, such as stormwater mitigation, aesthetics, energy conservation, wildlife habitat, and they increase property values. Trees look great, especially big trees in your front yard. So that's something that is an asset that we have that we like to maintain. There you go. Sorry for that false start there, Dan.
So our second point is that our vision emphasizes walkability and de-emphasizes cars. Given our proximity to employers, schools, colleges and hospitals, and the Wabash Station, our neighborhood is unique in Columbia. We are the most walkable neighborhood in the city, according to walkscore.com. I encourage you to visit this site to see how North Central compares to other parts of the city. This score is based on the number of services available within walking distance. The higher the score, the more likely you can meet your daily needs on foot. The highest score, Walker's Paradise, has been applied to some of the cities we aspire to be like: Minneapolis, Austin, Madison, Durham, Santa Cruz, and others. North Central comes close to Walker's Paradise score. We envision improvement in not only our walk score over time, but the walk scores of other key nodes in town. We can get there by making improvements to bike routes like the Bike Boulevard and Rangeline, creating a walkable city streetscape along Business Loop 70, building improved public transit systems, bus and even light rail along the Colt Corridor, and thoughtful city design and infill development that makes other locations in town attractive destinations available on foot. Point three, our vision maintains scale. We are predominantly a human scale neighborhood. The height, setback, style, and streetscape help shape this scale and results in a very comfortable feel. This is related to walkability. If you don't feel comfortable being in a space, you probably won't walk there. The scale and position of buildings, particularly older homes, naturally create community. From my front porch, I can communicate with all my adjacent neighbors on a daily basis. On most streets in our neighborhood, this is the norm. New homeowners and long-term renters have brought renewed energy to North Central. We've maximized the footprint of our homes to facilitate gardening in our front and side yards and expanded community gardening in empty lots. These strategies reduce property crime, strengthen community ties, and improve the health of seniors and persons of modest income while maintaining the human scale of the neighborhood. Nina Wilson-Keenan has the next 2 points.
North Central was annexed into the city limits in three segments, 1826, 1845, and 1906, and still contains streets and homes that date back to the 1880s, particularly along St. Joseph Street. Our infill history is mixed, from homeowners fixing up their houses, to duplex homes that are primarily rental, to fourplex apartments, to Columbia College renovated buildings, to warehouses, and more recently, dense student housing. Infill represents a significant investment in place. The bottom line we see is that there will be more people in North Central in the future. We envision that the new structures that bring people in will be a range of density, ownership types, use, and price, and most importantly to us, that it meets the scale of adjacent construction. Our concern with infill is not black and white, binary, yes, no response, but rather is a more realistic and pragmatic shades of gray. On particular infill method that has worked, or one particular infill method that has worked well in similar cities, is to create scale appropriate infill and promote home ownership and a policy to promote accessory dwellings units where the owners can occupy both or one of the structures. As a policy change, we ask the city to examine our zoning and construction codes and classifications and to permit accessory dwelling units for this purpose. Our fifth point is to expand mixed use through the form-based zoning code. A key area of interest we have is preserving residential districts in North Central. We believe that functioning residential neighborhoods have a balance of homeowners, business owners, and renters. Home ownership is good for our community and generates wealth for people in the middle class. It also provides a reprieve from the downtown core where buildings are larger, intensely occupied, and contain less tree coverage and green space. The neighborhood streets provide bikes and walkers preferred routes away from the main traffic corridors. Appropriate scale mixed-use infill is one of several strategies to guard against gentrification. If people of modest means can generate revenue in their living space by artisan or service-based work, they can continue to invest in the upkeep and restoration of their homes. Within these residential areas, and will reduce the guesswork that neighbors and developers encounter when embarking on infill projects. Form-based code districts can also inspire investment in a grand vision for an area because the neighboring property owners can have confidence that their investment will be congruent with past and future construction to create places that people want to be. We would like to be a pilot neighborhood for implementing form-based code. We are in support of the H3 design charrette that the Downtown Leadership Council spearheaded in 2010. We believe that the City Council should adopt the plan and implement the recommended next steps. We hope that the process used by H3 becomes a model for continued planning and processes. This is especially important when you consider the diverse group of North Central Columbia stakeholders. We want to collaborate with you, the DLC, and other neighborhood associations on strategies to promote the City Council's adoption of the H3 Design Charette Plan. Again, in summary, our vision for our neighborhood is this: protect our tree canopy, de-emphasize cars, and emphasize walkability. Maintain scale, increase density while guarding against gentrification, and expand mixed use through form-based zoning codes. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you. I'm Pat Fowler, and I have a letter for you. I think I have sufficient copies. Because of course, we have three action items we'd like to ask of you. One is adopting the design charette. The second is to include us in conversations about TIF districts. We know that conversations are ongoing, and we certainly would like to be a part of them. Both Adam and I have separately, we're the officers, current officers, we've had separate conversations with Mr. Mathis about places where TIF districts have encouraged and protected affordable home ownership and created live-work spaces for artists. We'd like to be part of that conversation, and we're ready and willing to take part in that at any time. So we'd like you to make sure that we're included in that. And third, we'd like to be the pilot area, not just the North Village area, but other areas of our neighborhood as well for form-based code. Adam serves on the Comprehensive Plan Task Force, and if there's any particular steps we need to take, either with city staff, with council, or with the Comprehensive Plan, please advise us so we can get on that to make sure that we are the pilot for form-based code. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let me ask a question. You know, and I don't know if you have a copy of the charette.
I do.
Page 19 on my copy. It shows North Central, Columbia College, and the Northeast Gateway. You know what I'm talking about.
Are we looking at the same map? Yes, sir. Yes.
We may not. But anyway,
mine's the same page, sir.
This is a question that has to do with, because number 10 on here, right at the corner of Rogers and 10th Street, they just put down campus housing. I mean, they just put that down there. Obviously, if that area gets developed, there'll be probably some people wanting, I don't know what they want to do. But campus housing seems to be the your issue right now around town, right? I mean,
we're aware that there's a commercial real estate boom in this country, and it's student right. housing, but that will also come to pass.
And this gets back to the philosophy about whenever we allow campus housing in, what should be our philosophy? Because they can come to us, and I had one potential developer say, well, we can put in parking for 40%. We can put parking in for 70%. We can insist on parking for 100%. I mean, we could. So that gets down to the issue, which is kind of paradoxical from my perspective. In other words, if we insist on 100% parking for cars in an infill development, well, we're kind of emphasizing that commuter culture, aren't we?
Well, let me talk a bit. I'm going to answer your question slightly adjacent to your question.
And the corollary to that is, if we would decide collectively that we really want to de-emphasize cars, should we not require minimal parking and let them fight it out? The problem, of course, is now the pressure that it spreads to other neighborhoods that you guys are experiencing right now. So it's just a philosophical decision. I don't know. I haven't really come up with something I'm comfortable with. I'd just be interested in your opinion.
Well, let me address those two separate questions, the parking question and the campus housing question. I think where North Central is concerned, because of our unique location, proximity matters. If Columbia College expands and has that many students that want to live adjacent to Columbia College, and that corner right there is owned by Columbia College, and they want to put in additional student housing, we have an excellent working relationship with Columbia College, and we trust that we could work with them effectively on that. But where you have the most unique amenity of downtown North Central is that we can walk everywhere. And if we take that over with a car culture that is not needed, given that we're so proximate to large employers, to two colleges and a university, we squander a very valuable asset. Now, when you're talking about how much parking we should have adjacent to housing, that's an issue that's a bigger issue that we're engaged in with PedNet and engaged in it on a bunch of different levels. Certainly, we've seen what happens when there is an adequate parking provision, and I think it's incumbent on the City Council to think ahead on those issues. There were quite a few missteps made by all of us in the instance of Brookside, and look where we are. You're going to have that on your agenda later today. But let's focus first on the proximity as an asset, and how with 774 units of affordable housing for people of modest means, the city and no one else that I know has the money to replace that housing elsewhere. We already have established corridors for student housing. There's still space out there if there's even continued demand for that. And I think we need to protect the asset that we have, sir.
If I could add something?
Sure.
I think part of the issue for the North Central Neighborhood Association is a matter of scale. At an appropriate scale, student housing, even with parking, can be accommodated without disrupting the rest of the neighborhood. And so I think it's a matter of looking at how we manage the scale of infill development and redevelopment. That's the real key. That would be my addition to that answer.
Yeah. Your point of what's the magic number? I think that's a great question. I don't know that answer. And it requires a really holistic strategy. I've been thinking a lot about parking. I've got parking issues on my street now because I live right next to Brookside. And I think it needs to be a holistic strategy of where long-term parking can be and where our car is needed on a day-to-day basis. And some students, if they have a job, they have to travel across town. That makes sense. But if it's long-term parking in front of my house that sits there for 2 weeks without being moved, I mean, that's not an optimal setup. So I don't know the answer to the question. It's a really good question. But I think promoting the walkability and the bikeability is going to encourage students to do more of the short trips by walking and not via car, which I think is the low-hanging fruit for
us. Guess, you know, what I'm agreeing with you is that we don't want to make it too easy to store. We certainly don't want cars stored in the North Village, and that's the risk we're running right now. So we're struggling with strategies to avoid that, and we're going to be talking about the transit system tonight in a couple of reports. So it's a dynamic situation. We got a lot of work to do, but you know, we don't want too many cars. But again, we have a commuter culture. The university has a commuter culture, and students are coming to town with cars, and we have to try to change that culture. That's our challenge.
Yeah, I agree, and that's part of the holistic strategy, is part of its habits.
I'm wondering if we shouldn't have some sort of follow-up from Mr. Teddy at some point as to how or if or in what manner North Central can be, you know, kind of formalize their involvement in some way. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, I don't want this report to fall on deaf ears or sit and not be acted upon. I just, you know, it would be nice to have something, some sort of maybe report back or some sort of, you know, report when the comp plan is finished and we're ready to do some form-based zoning to just acknowledge the fact that I think your neighborhood would be the perfect spot for to be the test case for that. I mean, I think we're all interested in seeing if it works, and I think it would be your neighborhood makes the most sense, I have to say. So I don't know if it would be proper to ask Mr. Teddy just to, you know, see if we can formalize it or to have something, some sort of follow-up at some point on this to make sure it doesn't get lost.
I guess for me, I just see this as a dynamic situation. We don't know how many students Columbia College is going to have in 10 years or 20 years. I hope they're very successful. But if they are very successful, obviously that's going to put pressures on the North Central Neighborhood Association. And we don't know what's going to happen, you know, in the North Village there when the Ameren UE property is, however they're going to dispose of it. We don't know how that's going to happen. This is a template, but I think what we have to understand is this is dynamic. We just need to keep talking. You know, we need to stay engaged because we don't know what trends were going to happen. You know, for example, in this charrette, they talked about, I think they talked about 250 apartments over 10 years. Yeah, and, you know, again, they did the best they could, but sometimes things dramatically change. We don't see changes going on, and that's happened, which is had some consequences that were not really intended here. So your neighborhood being so close to Columbia College and abutting the North Village and being so close to, you know, the FASCAT, what's that going to do? Is that going to make more students want to live there if it's successful? So, again, this is dynamic, and I think a report's fine, but that's a static statement, and I think this is a dynamic process. And we just simply need to continue to be engaged all the way. And as we talk about, how do we deal with parking? You know, do we want to make it hard for them to park, or do we want to make it easy for them to park? And again, we'll just have to work our way through that.
If I can make a comment about more students wanting to live in North Central, we have a larger number of renters right now than we have homeowners. And we all know that homeowners stabilize the neighborhood, particularly for our seniors and our children. So we want to lure families back to our neighborhood. We want to keep our seniors independent in their homes. But I also want to draw to your attention what I think is an excellent example of bringing increased density to an existing lot, and that's 300 College Ave. It's the building that was built by Bob and Carol Groves probably 6 or 7 years ago. It was initially used as the transitional living program for the women's shelter. But if you go over and you stand in front of it, it first is a house with a very interesting facade, which he renovated and refurbished. And then it has two buildings, they're separate but attached with breezeways, that are exact mirrors of the primary building. And so they increased the density on this lot. They worked with the Benton Stevens Neighborhood Association. I think it's a beautiful example of how we can increase density and serve those needs of students that want to walk to their campuses or to school. And I hope that we have, I didn't have a chance to look at the zoning and how that all went down, but I know they needed some either a Board of Adjustment hearing or some variances for that. But I think that that's an excellent model that we would like to look at more carefully for our neighborhood, where you have the front structure that has good elements to it. Let's try that as an approach to bring the density up in our neighborhood, which we welcome. We want more neighbors. We all just don't want to be displaced from our current uses. We want to stay there too.
I'd just echo that. The point about the accessory dwelling units is the same, similar strategy. There's a lot of great examples of this happening. Santa Cruz really wrote the book on accessory dwelling units, and they went through a lot of the growing pains. And that would be a great place to research. That would be a recommendation that I would encourage you all to do, is to get that into committee or wherever it needs to go, to do the research and figure out what would need to be done to encourage that. We have a lot of narrow, very deep lots in this town. That would be a really scale-appropriate way to increase density. The houses are modest size, so by default, they're going to be relatively low rent. So that's part of that low-income housing problem that we're trying to figure out as well. And so that's just one really pragmatic policy that's been used by other cities that I think would be a really good fit here.
Would it be reasonable for it to ask planning for a report on that?
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Research and give us a sense of where that stands. And
has that been part of the comprehensive plan discussion?
Yeah, I've brought that up in that form as well. But it is in there at some point.
Involved in that.
It's also part of the 2008 Affordable Housing Task Force study and report. And they didn't call them accessory dwelling units, but they talked about putting additional structures. They might have called them in-law apartments. And that is a recommendation that I know there needs to be some zoning change about. We had some conversations with Mr. Teddy about that time. And I just want to remind you that, again, you know, we've been talking about affordable housing, and I've been involved in that conversation since at least 2007 when I started attending their meetings. And here we have a neighborhood that is the best example of that in Columbia, and we want to protect that.
I've done a fair bit of research on this already, so if I can connect with somebody, I'll pass along information.
Betty can give you a call.
I'm actually wondering if for the accessory dwelling unit, we need to wait for the completion of the comprehensive plan, or if we're sure enough about that that we could maybe proceed with that, because we know it's going to be part of it. And you, since you're on the task force, you might be able to speak to that issue, because my neighborhood is all R2, and it would be wonderful, and there are all those deep lots. It would really be wonderful if we could redesign zoning so it's not those icky duplexes, but people could put cottages. Everywhere I can think of where that's allowed, Corona Del Mar, California, Berkeley, California, the property values are much higher, and the neighborhoods are much more livable. So I'd be really interested in your thoughts on that.
I would encourage to move forward on that. Personally, I think it's a good idea. It's been adopted by a lot of communities, and there's been a lot of research done on it. So I think.
And I don't think that it at all deters or takes away from the comp plan process, because it's a rather broad process. And I think anytime you can do bring in research from a success somewhere else in the country and study that and bring that to the table, that, we'll be better prepared to make the changes we need to make. So I agree. I think that we should definitely move forward.
So we should move forward and not wait on the comp plan.
Yeah, I mean, it may end up coming in at the same time, or it may be, but I think we need to report back. And if, we'll let Mr. Teddy tell us when the appropriate time is for it to be implemented.
The interesting thing is we'd like to have a complete comprehensive plan, but there may be already pieces that we all agree on, whatever the plan is, that's going to be in it. And if we can do that, I know lots of people that want to build a house now or need to build a house now. And that's why I think it's, I'd be really interested in your thoughts on that. Obviously, we'd want to have the approval of the task force. But
sure, yeah, and I can't speak for the whole comprehensive task force, but as a member of that, I think you're on the right track. And
let's just say we requested that and it was on first reading next time, that we could maybe delay it a meeting or two to give the task force a chance to look it over. If like a miracle occurs and we push that piece through right away,
I don't know the timeline on the task force. It's going to be a while.
The point being that we could accommodate that, just to make sure that everybody's happy.
This will take a lot longer than.
Yeah, I think this is going to take a bit.
This is a more substantial work product for the planning department, I would suspect.
I appreciate you all being proactive, and I think looking at mixed use ahead of time, because a lot of times when we look at infill development, and then it comes up kind of after the fact, and so when we were when I was discussing this with some kind of stakeholders, we thought it would be ideal if neighborhoods could kind of proactively look ahead and look for the kind of development that they would want, so that. That it's not going to cause a kerfluffle, but because we all like these things in principle, but then when it gets down to the nitty-gritty details. So I really like, and I definitely can endorse your vision for your neighborhood. It looks like great, and you've done some nice work, and I appreciate it.
Thank you for your participation and your ideas. It's great. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I just wanted to mention that one thing is that people try to kind of lump in projects in the district with projects in the North Village, which is apples and oranges. And we're not seeing the same kind of problems downtown, because you already have the infrastructure for the meters, for city garages and such that we don't have. So unfortunately, in my neighborhood, we were ripe to be an overflow parking lot for this building with a lack of pre-planning. So I think that my neighbors and I, we keep coming up here because we really do want to see a commitment from the city to preserve our historical traditional housing stock, because once it's gone, we can't get it back. And you're talking about this being fluid, and this is going to keep going. So, we need to partner with you to try to preserve these houses, because people like different options to live. And unfortunately, if you push out our housing, what you're going to end up with is nothing but commercial developments in downtown and no ownership in downtown. I think that's important, and I think it's important that we commit to these streets, because I'm from Lubbock, Texas. We had the largest private redevelopment project in the U.S. And even in that project, there was single-family homes and opportunities for home ownership that were written into that project. So I'm kind of surprised that we're not also looking at that as being a facet of our planning. But I just kind of wanted to bring that to attention because, you know, when you think about downtown, there's not this expectation of having a parking space. If you live kind of in a neighborhood, there's sort of a different expectation by the renters. And I think that needs to be acknowledged. Thanks.
Thank you very much. We'll move on to the ICMA.
Yes, Adam or Pat, could you email me the Prezi link? Thanks. Where at him? Oh, great, never mind. You'll remember in last, the budget before last, we introduced the idea of signing up for joining the ICMA Center for Performance Management Measurement. They keep changing what the M means, or I can't remember, one or the other. But the gist of it is that it is the probably the largest benchmark source of data in the U.S. City to city. It also has templates about how you conduct the measures. And so in the greatest degree possible, you're measuring apples to apples across city governments. And Leland's going to walk us through when we find the document. There you go. The results from that first year. So there are 15 templates. We entered data, our data, into the system across many of those templates, not all. And we have done the comparison, the study of looking at the field, seeing what our performance was relative to the group. And so today I'm pleased to show this to you. Leland.
Thanks. So, yeah, we're going to go through the ICMA performance measurements. This is from our 2011 data. A quick overview of what we'll be looking at. We're going to look at what this tool is, how the performance measurement tool actually works, why we're using it, some basic trends and an example of how it can be used, and some ideas for taking it forward. So the ICMA, or the International Center of International Association of City Managers, Center for Performance Measurement, collects and cleans this data yearly. There's about 1,000 questions in 18 different service areas. These are kind of like departments, so police services, planning. About 10 to 20 core measures per service. These are the ones that we use to benchmark each other against other cities per capita, per 1,000. They also provide us with data, graphs, reports, case studies. The cost of this is about $5,550 per year to get these services. Who participates in this survey? There's about 195 cities. There's two levels of participation. There's a CPM 101, it's a much very basic level. There's also a CPM comprehensive level. That's a level we participated in. And most of the cities participate in the comprehensive level. About 170 of those 195 cities are participating at that level. The cities also exist in consortia. These are groups of cities that come together to share data and have specific questions just for them. There's a cold weather consortia. There's a college town consortia. Most of them are geographic. Kansas City and St. Louis metropolitan areas both have consortia. The population distribution is fairly even for the group, with about a quarter of them being cities greater than 100,000, 40% being between 25 and 100,000, and 35% representing smaller communities underneath 25,000. There's also a broad range of different governments. There's counties, there's council managers, council mayors, a great deal of variety, including the county cities of Virginia that are in here. So to kind of aid us in looking at this data, we plucked out some peer cities to help us with benchmarking. It is a relatively small sample, so we use population as pretty much our only determinant to be included in this group and came up with about 30 cities to compare ourselves. Now, overall, these cities were higher performers and also had higher response rates in the service areas to the core core measures. You look at the response rates right here. They seem relatively low, usually below 50% per service area. I wouldn't be too dismayed by that. Cities have different services. Some cities do certain things. Also, the ICMA is very good about emphasizing that you should only measure what you're actually going to use. A lot of cities just don't choose to measure certain things because they aren't useful to them. So whenever you see...
Confused. The response rate is what exactly?
To the core measures, the ones that we use to benchmark.
And response rate means how...
If they answered it at all.
Ah.
So anytime you're looking at a sample, that 195 gets cut down even smaller, even within the 30 when you're looking at it. So sometimes we're not comparing ourselves to that many cities, per se.
So this chart would say that of our peer cities, 52% answered questions about code enforcement.
That's correct. Overall, the peer cities did a much better job of responding to questions. These are also cities that generally have full-service cities.
Unfortunately, it lends itself to selection bias.
Certainly. You're comparing yourself against some much higher caliber cities, which honestly is probably where we want to be comparing ourselves anyway. So why we want to use this tool? Performance measurement is central to our current strategic plan effort. We need measurements. It provides a nice uniform format for measurement and for data, so that's something that if you're measuring it the same way over in Public Works, or measuring it the same way over in the planning department. So it gives us this nice uniform system of place to collect all of this data. It is still a relatively large sample compared to other tools out there. The citizen survey generally, I think, only benchmarks us against I think it's 15 or 20 cities at most. So having this many cities is kind of nice. It also provides opportunities for data sharing with other cities and enables better communication of our performance measures. It gives us nice core measures per thousand, per FTE, per capita that kind of help us communicate these ideas a lot better. So we're going to look at some general trends, and many of these won't be surprises to you if they've come up already before in the budgeting process. So in this one, we're looking at police. The kind of the general trend that's seen throughout the city, especially in police, is less staff with a greater workload. So if you look at the left, you'll see Columbia. The darker green one is the number of sworn FTEs, where on the right, the light green represents the UCR Part 1 violent crimes. UCR is a uniform crime report. It's a way of reporting crime to the FBI. These are what you would think of as your high-level violent crimes.
Can I ask a question about FTEs?
Certainly.
Do you include university police force?
No, this is only the city police force as we reported it.
And this is always difficult. Because should you or not, because we have, what is it, 1.4 per thousand police officers, and there are 30 university police officers, 35, under 40. They obviously do some police work. They do traffic enforcement. They deal with crimes on campus. So they are doing some of the police work in our community. And so of those 30 FTEs, how many of, what should we count them as? Should we count them as 10 FTEs or 5 or 20 or 30? I don't know the answer to that.
I think that's a good answer and a good issue for looking at consortia, where we can get in these groups of other cities that are in the similar, like the College Town Consortia or University Consortia, so we can make that a point that we're going to share that kind of data and that we're going to be able to compare ourselves in a more even process.
And then I guess there's another question, too, of numerator and denominator is if we whether we're including the MUPD and are we also including the crimes that occur on campus separately. That's sort of the conundrum of Central Park doesn't have a crime rate because it has no population, so it has crimes but no population. And we're having sort of an analogous thing here. We have a population that's housed on campus. We have crimes that occur there. We have a police force there. We could, I would imagine we could do ourselves, compare ourselves to these cities both ways.
Well, let me give this kind of caveat. This is very general trends. You'll be seeing these numbers used by the specialists in each of these service areas. This data comes with tons of comments for each row that cities provide to help us understand whether it's a good comparison or not. So when you start drilling down for more detailed information or trying to really compare ourselves, you can find that information in the data. But as far as looking for general trends, I didn't want to send an entire table up here with comments and different aspects of these different cities. Uh-huh. And certainly you're highlighting a lot of the challenges with using this data as well.
Both have hit on key things to remember as we look at this tool. The nice part is it can help us find really high-performing cities, but there's a lot of detail to wade through to get there.
And you'll see more examples of that as we go along and as we drill down a little further. Here's another interesting point. We can use two service areas to kind of see something that's going on from the city. Solid waste and fleet maintenance are two different service areas, so we can kind of look at the cost of maintenance. So in this graph, we see the cost of maintenance per truck and preventative maces. This preventative maintenance, this is for the Packer trucks, the trash trucks. See, we're paying a lot more right now than our peer cities or the other reporting cities for maintenance. And the obvious answer when you go in the data is our trucks on average are much older, about 80 months compared to our peer cities' trucks that are about 60 months. That's a difference about 8 and 6 years. an age of trucks.
And it may be, that may be the cheaper way to do it overall in terms of the total cost of providing service. We don't know necessarily. A new fleet isn't a good thing.
We do provide, as far as collection, we are one of the cheapest. It's about $31 per ton or per account. I can't remember which way it goes, but it is very, definitely on the cheap side. And that's just a collection. That's just how much we pay the employees to pick it up and some of the associated costs of the truck. That's not some of the further cost out. So some of the citywide trends that at least I had the chance to see, there was at first a lack of perception or satisfaction measures for our internal services. This has highlighted the problem that our data stream wasn't perfect. We do capture that, how satisfied our folks are with HR services or with procurement services, but it just didn't sync with when the data was due for ICMA, which is something we need to look at in the future, is how we get all of these to kind of get into a nice cycle where they all feed into each other. The other kind of trend that we've seen is just underfunding in certain service areas, such as public safety, roads, IT. But at the same time, you're getting really good performance out of the fewer folks that you have. We're seeing that they're still performing at the same level, right there at the averages for the peer cities, the averages for all the reporting cities. So at the same point, you guys are getting a very good value out of using less full-time employees, and that's coming from more training or from positions that act as multiplier effects or just having a higher quality workforce. So now we're going to kind of just dive into a little example to show you some of the issues with the data and some of the exciting things you can do with it. ICMA provides us with case studies. The most recent case study that came up was out of Dartmouth, Massachusetts, looking at pay-as-you-throw. Pay-as-you-throw, as I'm sure many of you are familiar with, is you pay per trash bag or per can, or even some places do it by weight, how much weight you actually of trash you actually produce. For Dartmouth, this was a very big change for them. It reduced their cost of collection of trash drastically. It increased it from about 10%. We have 44% of their collected material became recycling, whereas before they had about 10 to 15% going towards recycling. When you do that, that also brings down the net expenditures for recycling become significantly less. And they use their savings to upgrade their trucks and their system. They actually lost one refuse truck. There was no more demand for it, and put that money towards buying more recycling trucks. And we look at Columbia, we're seeing a flat rate, still low cost for collection, but only 10% of our material that's being collected going to recycling. So here's kind of an example. We can start looking at the numbers to see whether this is something that would work here or whether it's even worth looking at. And we look at the average tons of refuse collected. We can see that we're collecting more per account than folks that are not using pay-as-you-throw, folks that are using pay-as-you-throw, as our peer cities, and as all the reporting cities. Drilling down and look at the percentage, and this is just for 2011. Looking at the percentage of recycled materials for all collected materials, we see that we're also only collecting 10% compared to even cities that don't use pay-as-you-throw, cities that do use pay-as-you-throw, are collecting more. Our peer cities and all the reporting cities for ICMA are collecting more. But the nice thing about ICMA is we don't just have to look at 2011. We can track this over time. They have online data back to 2003. This is probably the most interesting part of using this data because we can look at our performance over time. And in this chart, you can see that even over time, as far as the average tons of refuse collected per account, the pay-as-you-throw systems have collected less over almost a 10-year period. And the same is with the percentage of materials collected over time. They've continued to collect a higher percentage. It's kind of interesting. I was trying to correlate it where the jump in 2007. I think it kind of went with the economy. Everyone decided they could save money by not throwing away as much trash or putting as much bags out and increase their recycling, because there's a lot of the same cities from 2007 to 2009. This also correlates with your expenditures on recycled material. The more you collect, the less you have to spend per account. So that trend has maintained itself throughout time, where pay-as-you-throw systems have required less. So it looks okay, and we also, where you can bring in the external factors, it's provided, this data has provided something, okay, it looks like it works now, let's really dig into it. And the case studies give us some of that information as well. Like I've already mentioned, Columbia, you already have a very low cost for collection in Columbia. Pay-as-you-throw would create a true utility for solid waste. There's certainly the positive benefits for recycling and cost savings. But as the case study noted, that there's some real barriers, and there were barriers in that community in Dartmouth, Massachusetts as well. How do you account for low-income people with large families who could be burdened by this system, or elderly folks? How do you educate students every year in a town like this that they need to put a tag on their trash to put it on the curb? How do you deal with apartments as always an issue with solid waste collection. And in Columbia, there's been a history of us looking at this issue and deciding not to do it in the past as well. So whether this is a good time to do it now, whether this data enlightens us or changes our mind, it's something to kind of give us a little bit more information than we've had in the past to make these decisions. So going forward, as far as the usefulness of this tool, it's particularly useful internally for us to track our own progress and performance. It has some good usefulness in benchmarking, looking at cities similar to us. Probably the most exciting thing, in my opinion, is time series data, being able to look at our performance and track it over time. It also gives us the ability to explore, such as the example I just provided, new ways of providing service here in Columbia. It's also being incorporated extensively into our strategic plan. If you go through and look for performance measures, you'll see them referencing ICMA data. It's finding its way into our citizen survey. That data, citizen survey data, feeds into the ICMA data for a lot of the satisfaction measures. And it's also going to have to come into this idea of this annual collection analysis and reporting cycle, where everything flows nicely and we generate reports and that there isn't something that misses out because of when it was due. As far as what employees thought, I surveyed the 30 employees that had to deal with this data, organize it, and eventually work with it. We had about 50% response rate from that survey. Would seeing performance over time be useful? The majority of our employees that had to deal with it think that would be particularly useful, being able to see our measurement this year, next year, and the year after that to see how we're doing over time as a way of tracking our progress. And is this something that we should continue? And there's still a majority of these employees that believe that this is something that should continue. I think some of them are unsure because we only have that one snapshot, that 1 year of data. It was kind of rushed to find it. We don't know where it all is yet. So I think next year when we have more numbers, we can compare ourselves to last year. I think we'll see more employees excited to use this data. There are some weaknesses to this. It is a relatively small sample. 195 cities is only 1% of all municipalities in the United States, with a high degree of variability, counties, cities, different governance forms. It lacks some measures for certain areas that we have here, such as public health, for 911 call center. There's no really good measures in there for that. And for our public communications, it doesn't have great measures. And it requires some organization on our part and some data cleaning to be able to use it and make it accessible. But certainly going forward, it's something where we can share data as far as using a college town consortium, where we can really look at questions that we're really interested in. It provides opportunities for deeper analysis into our performance. It provides a great tool for us to report our data to citizens and to our staff and to council. And also is a big step in creating a performance culture here. You can't do that unless you actually measure data and use it from year to year. And at that point, I'll be glad to take any questions or comments you have about it.
Well, I agree with the criticisms about the 1%, but 1% is better than 0%, and this is a great
start. You're not
going
to find a tool that's going to collect more cities at this level with this many measures.
That's the shocking part of this. This is the largest, best tool in the country.
Well, and what I would think would be really important is, insofar as they're providing models and frameworks within which to do surveys, if we're making our measures conform to their measures, we are probably right there getting our money's worth, because we're doing surveys and doing performance measurement in a more standardized way.
And so it finds a good template for us to collect data.
Yeah, the template was the word you used. And that just is going to make the data set much more comparable and much more useful to all the members.
My short time on council, I can't think of how many times I've seen where we've asked for comparable data from other cities. And we've looked at 3, 4, 5 cities, and that it really helps us inform our choices and decide how to do it. So even if our core cities are 30 and half of them are responding, that's 15 cities, which is significantly better than what we can do anecdotally, and less room for just overt selection bias.
And if this is really the biggest, I'm sure it's going to grow. We sure.
That's our hope, and we are looking into participating in the consortia where university or college towns sort of group themselves together, and our hope is that'll help put us in some company that, for example, all have the same crime problem, right? In terms of, do you count the campus police in or not? And at least we can compare ourselves to cities with that same issue. Same question, I should say, not problem. So So our intent moving forward is to, one, dig more deeply on this. So we are reworking our citizen survey to accommodate some of the services we provide, so we'll have better data that way. Imagine being able to compare how our residents feel about our service compared to how, you know, Poughkeepsie's residents feel about it. Those, many people argue, is the most important performance measure. So that's that will be an exciting thing to know. So we're doing that now, and of course also hoping that more cities get involved, just as you say, Fred. Well, with that, that's the presentations tonight.
Let's take a break and be ready to start at 7 o'clock sharp.